call to order the House Education Committee for the March 1st, 2017. Okay, well, first thing we're going to do is going to have an informational hearing. So I open an informational session from the Chief Education Office on the State Longitudinal Data System. And so Lindsay Capps, Peter Tromba, and John Starr. We are anxious to hear about the State Longitudinal Data System.
Chair Doherty, Vice Chair Wilson, members of the committee, for the record, Lindsay Capps, Chief Education Officer, and it's my pleasure to come today and provide an update on the building of our statewide longitudinal data system. The SLDS, as we call it in short, is a core function and statutory responsibility of the Chief Education Office as a P20 coordinating agency. To begin with, a statewide longitudinal data system is defined as a data system that collects and maintains detailed, high-quality data over time that is linked across the education continuum. And it provides a complete view of the academic life and performance of a student. One of the most significant benefits of having a coordinated statewide longitudinal data system is the ability to inform educators, institutions, communities, and policymakers about key drivers impacting student success over time and across all sectors of education in Oregon. By providing reporting and analysis tools, the longitudinal data system can be used to evaluate programs, policies, practices, and resource allocation decisions, not only at the state but at the local level, to improve student outcomes. As far as our initial work to date, the Chief Education Office has completed the initial transfer of data from the Oregon Department of Education and the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. So for the first time, pulling data together from across our K-12 and higher ed system. And we are working for additional data consumption from other participating state agencies, including the Oregon Department of Employment, the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, and the Early Learning Division within the Oregon Department of Education. By pulling together this data across all sectors, we are on track to join Washington, Nevada, and 14 other states across the nation that have full and complete longitudinal data systems. Other states, including Alaska, Hawaii, Idaho, North Dakota, and Utah, have longitudinal data systems linking at least three of the four core sectors that I mentioned. Colorado and Wyoming are still in the process of building their complete P20 longitudinal data systems, with Oregon as being another state in that process. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to our interagency research and policy director to talk a little bit more about the benefits of the longitudinal data system and how it can serve the needs of different users.
Thank you very much, Lindsay. For the record, my name is Peter Tromba, interagency policy research director. Chair Doherty, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be able to address this topic with all of you. And I do want to call out before I start talking that my career up in state government is fairly short. Most of my career, I was a public school principal and district office administrator in Oregon. And so a number of these examples that we're picking out here, whether it's institutional or classroom, are based on firsthand experience or experience that I've had in working with other colleagues throughout the educational system in Oregon. So what we've done is we've listed five major audiences for the state longitudinal data system, and I'd like to call out one or two examples of how each of those groups might use the system. And obviously for the policymaker one and probably for other ones in there, that might touch off a question, so that might be the time to go back and forth a little bit. So first off, for policymakers, and I'm considering those of you up there at the dais to be just a key example of how policymakers might use this. You would be able to use this to evaluate programs, policies, and resource allocation decisions at the state level and to a large degree at local levels to be able to establish effectiveness of programs and also do some forecasting of what's going to happen in the future. So a couple real concrete examples. Right now, we are having discussions in the state about dual credit. And there are a lot of different ways students can get dual credit right now in Oregon, from AP, IB, to various hybrid options, classes taught at a community college, lots and lots. Well, which ones have the greatest long-term outcome for students in our state? Right now, we're answering that question based on comparing it to other states or kind of dead reckoning from just information that we have. The state longitudinal data system is going to allow us to look at those actual students who got actual dual credit and follow them over time and ask a question like, well, does AP or IB do better in terms of college completion? Or which dual credit option really leads to higher paying jobs or whatever you might think. We would be able to evaluate things like dual credit using data rather than sort of a patchwork of data and guesswork. A second example is, and there's been a lot of discussion about, especially we had this at the Ways and Means Committee this week and last week, what are the alignment opportunities and gaps between high school preparation and the community college and university entrance exams? And I'm sure all of you have heard, we've heard about students who've done successful at the high school level and then find themselves in developmental ed after that. Well, the question is, who are those students who are in that gap? And longitudinally, what is the effect of that lack of alignment and for whom? Because I think what we'll find, and I think it's something we have to explore in the data, there's a differential effect of a lack of a seamless system. So if we have a 90% seamless system in terms of that gap, who's most affected by that 10% lack of seamlessness? You'll get to see that in longitudinal data. Finally, when you think about forecasting, maybe sort of prospectively looking in the future, what would an investment of one more dollar in Oregon pre-K likely result in over time? By looking at current Oregon pre-K students or any previous expansion that we've had in that program and following out the longitudinal progress from students. There's a lot of really provocative data about early learning, and it's provocative because it says that the downstream effects of early learning are not seen in elementary school. They're seen way downstream, career, college completion, incarceration, things like that. So sometimes we make these decisions about short-term or based on a short-term metric of change when really we need to look at a long-term. And there's a lot of suspicion that as we go back in time in our lives, things that happen really early in life, early childhood experiences, are the ones most likely to have that lasting impact. We'll be able to look at that with Oregon data. Secondly, for institutions, and this could be a school, a community college, university, private school, anybody you can imagine, GED program, any sort of institutional approach, how do we evaluate collective efficacy towards the goals that we have? So for instance, as a high school principal, that's a job I used to do, we used to get information back from the OUS system about how our students did at OUS schools. Not by student, it was aggregated, but it was fascinating data that we would show back with our teachers and we'd look at how are we doing. Our system is going to provide that type of institutional data at the student level, and not just for the four-year universities, but also for community colleges and eventually for private professional certificate awarding institutions and the like. So as a teacher or a principal or a community college president or whatever, you're going to be able to look farther. And honestly, if you want to make an argument as a leader at your school that your staff need to change or need to do something differently, longitudinal real-life outcome data is way more persuasive than a smarter balanced test score to make that compelling argument with your staff. With respect to researchers in our staff at the Department of Ed, Higher Ed Coordinating Commission, Youth Development, Early Learning, TSPC, and others, we're dying to get the chance to be able to do research using a system like this for a variety of reasons. But one is because most of the time when we do research that we present to you, we do what's called a snapshot. We take a snapshot of John Smith Elementary School in the third grade. Next year, we take another snapshot in third grade. We keep showing you different kids every year and how they did in third grade. That's nowhere near as powerful as looking at the individual students' growth and progress over time. I mean, think of your own children and what you pay attention to. You're paying attention to their growth over time. As researchers, there are questions that we can ask with an SLDS, State Longitudinal Data System, we've never been able to ask before. For instance, what's the cumulative effect for an African-American student who never sees a teacher of color throughout their educational career? Or what's the protective factors inherent in a student who has a male elementary teacher in his or her first 6 years of school? There's a belief out there that those kinds of influences, especially at early education, make a difference. You know, another thing to think about, what's the cumulative effect of an individual student who seven straight years, their average class size is over 35, versus another student where that doesn't happen every year? Is there a cumulative effect or not? For educators, lots of educational practices that occur in the classroom, just like the institutional one, don't play out right away. I'll pick two that happen all the time. One is advisory. If you've ever worked in a secondary school, middle and high school teachers tend to not want to do like an advisory program unless they can be shown it has powerful effects. This is a way to document that over time. Another example that educators are very interested in is the educational plan and profile, which is state law that in our state, starting in seventh grade, every student develops an educational plan and profile so that they're more prepared for their next steps. What's the effect of that? And for the educators spending their time filling out those profiles and doing those things with the student, well, what happens with that student over time? If you're talking to educators, being able to make that kind of argument is really compelling. And then finally, for students and families, imagine being able to take a look at your local district, your local school, and ask the question of what are the long-term longitudinal effects or pathways that students follow from that program. It might really change your mind about a CTE program in your school when you discover that although it costs a lot to invest in that welding program, the graduates from that particular school are doing really, really well because of it. That's something that I've seen in a high school that I worked at, a particular program. It was spendy, had a lot of effects, and I see one fan among the committee. So those are the chief benefits that we've seen for each of these different groups. And again, I thank you for the opportunity to address the committee.
Thank you. I think we'll wait till the whole panel's done for questions. Are you done?
Yeah.
Are you done? Okay.
Yes.
Thank you very much. The other gentleman's here, sir, for expert attention and expert advice. Okay, are there any questions for the panel? Representative Springer and Representative Solman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my first question is, first of all, Peter, great job on explaining the uses of the data.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how anybody could disagree with that. That is phenomenal. How did we get here today to hear this report, Lindsay, on this system? What precipitated this system?
Thank you, Chair Doherty, Representative Springer. This system was established as a directive under the Oregon Education Investment Board when it was established in 2011. And we've been in the process since that time of planning and developing the system. We've gone through fairly significant legislative oversight as well as complied with the state stage gate process required of major IT projects and received approval to move forward with implementation and the funding and are on track to complete the project by the end of 2017.
Follow up, Madam Chair, please. Thank you. You weren't in this role in 2011, and I get that. And I'm looking at Senate Bill 909, and on the first page in 2011, and I was a yes vote on this, we talked about this system 6 years ago. 6 years ago. And I know there's a lot to do with a system and to create a system, and we sure don't want another Cover Oregon kind of thing, and I get that. But, you know, I'm kind of beating a drum mm-hmm. this session. And I don't know how long, whether we think the OEIB is a great thing or a bad thing, how long we're going to have it. But keep in mind that one of the results of it is coming to fruition 6 years later. And this is what I've talked about. We change things so quickly, and we don't give things a chance to occur, that we get rid of them before they even happen.
Yes.
And 6 years to get to this presentation. How much information, how many things did we not learn in the last 6 years?
Is that a comment or a question?
Oh, that was purely a comment. Shameless.
Yeah. But that's good. That's good. Okay, Representative Solomon and Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I, too, also want to echo Representative Springer to say thank you so much for this information. My question comes to how and who and how does one get their hands on how they have access to this system?
Yeah, sure. Chair Doherty, members of the committee, Representative Solomon, thank you very much for the question. It's one thing that has been one of the most compelling questions that we've had from the very beginning to make sure that we are great custodians of the data and make it available in a way that makes a difference for all the groups that we've just listed. So. And we can go in and provide you this incredible technical diagram of this, but just a short version of it is the data that we get comes from the Oregon Department of Education and the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission and an internal process that no one from the public, you, anybody who's not authorized to see that sensitive information is able to access it. There's a process where the data from the two agencies is linked together to make these longitudinal records. That also has personal information in it, because the only way to link information is using personal information. However, the whole time while the data is in our system, it's encrypted continuously. So even though the members of our team can log in and use it, no one can see it, no one can get in, and even if they could, it would be encrypted. After the data's been linked, it's the personally identifiable information is taken out. It's called de-identified data. So the final system that anybody would look at, including a researcher without specific permission, it would all be not personally identifiable. Now, right now, the Department of Ed, Higher Ed Coordinating Commission, and others produce stuff on the web. And the one thing that they do is they do something called data suppression. So even if data is personally not identifiable, if I did a search of someone from Sweet Home who majored in this particular subject and graduated in this particular year, I might be able to start to fix down on a particular person. And so what our system will also do, besides being not personally identifiable, is it won't let you search all the way down and find a tiny little cell of information. So given those safeguards, that allows us to actually let the public log into the system and be able to look at some level of it. It allows folks with a higher level of access to have another level. And then finally, for the internal system administrators who have the highest level, they would be able to see. But in John's diagram, there's like three firewalls. Mm-hmm. It was like no way in. Mm-hmm. So.
Follow up? Thank you, Chair. So I'm sorry, please tell me, is this available now?
Sorry.
Is it live? No?
No, Rep. Doherty, members of the committee, I'm sorry, I probably wasn't responsive to your question.
No, you were. No, that was part of it, and then it just kind of calculated something else. So.
Thank you. It's not available yet. It'll be ready by the end of the year, and it'll be available on a web page. So you'll log on to a web page, and there'll be all these tools for you to make these. Let me show you a really cool example. This is a visualization that a member of the public would be able to just pull up. It's been shamelessly borrowed by our agency from others in our state at the Oregon Business Council who've showed this off. Echo Northwest did it. We're going to create a similar version of it that folks would be able to lay out and take a look at this pathways of progress for Oregon students.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Parrish.
Oh, okay.
Thanks. And then Representative, I've got to list down.
So I also supported Senate Bill 909, and but at the time, and I still have folks who are worried about this, there are people who maybe don't want their child's data tracked, even though it's not going to be publicly available in a forward-facing way. It is going to be aggregated somewhere behind closed doors. And so how do parents opt out of being part of this if that's their choice?
Representative Doherty, members of the committee, as my understanding is, I'm only going to give a very brief answer, and I'm just going to ask to be able to follow up in detail. We're not the collector of the data, and I don't mean to shift responsibility, but I want to honor that we don't actually collect the data the Oregon Department of Education does. There's particular data that's considered the right of the state to collect without the ability of families to opt out, and then there's other data where I think there might be some availability to do that, so I'd want to check back on it. But certain elements of student data is considered to be the province of the state for program approval improvement, even though it also is individual data. So if a student attending a school, that's publicly available information, and there's some other things that are public. But I'll give a more complete answer, but I think I'm gonna have to call on ODE to help us out in terms of the collection.
I guess the follow-up. So currently, as a parent, kid in schools, I understand that there are certain data that you're gonna collect. We're now taking that data in a way that maybe parents don't understand is going to happen and manipulating that data into this longitudinal piece. And that might be something parents don't understand is happening with that data, and we're not certainly having a conversation with them that that's about to happen. And so I think that there are going to be people who are going to be concerned. I have certainly talked to parents about this, because it's one thing to say, well, we've historically collected this data. We're now putting it into a very different form, even if, like I said, the underlying student identifying information is not publicly facing. They're part of that data set. It's no different than when I take my kid to the pediatrician and they ask if they want, you know, they use their blood samples in a private way. I still get a chance to opt in or out of that as a parent. And so I think that there's going to have to be some level of communication with the public that this is happening. And similar to how we've allowed folks to opt out of testing, there might be folks who want to opt out of their child's data being used in this way. And I think we're going to have to be sensitive to that.
Thank you. Representative Evans.
I have three very brief questions. Mm-hmm. The first one will be the easiest. What date will this be done? End of year means what to us?
Chair Doherty, Representative Evans, December of 2017.
Okay, groovy, that'll work. Yep. Got it to a month. Second question, real brief. To Representative Parrish's point, having been involved in programs that released a lot of data that wasn't necessarily contextualized, is the agency or agencies, are they prepared for the very likely across the spectrum questioning of what choices we as a community are making in terms of education when they can take out of context little bits and pieces? Are we ready for a narrative that help explains all the different pieces to a very complex system is the question.
Chair Doherty, Representative Evans, I think one of the, as you heard Mr. Tromba talking about, one of the opportunities that we have at the state level or the system level is to determine what types of research questions we want to systemically ask. And so I think there's an opportunity to think about how those are framed in ways that best address some of the systemic needs or barriers or challenges that we have. And I think, as with any type of research, there is a framing opportunity for that. Otherwise, the data is fairly neutral. Right. At the local level, I think part of what will be available will, I think, be contextual. So depending on the user, if it's a practitioner, they may use it in a particular way. How that aggregates up into larger policy questions, I don't think we know where that will go. So I think that's I think it's an important thing for us to be thinking about as we, to Representative Parrish's point, how we frame the use of this system.
And here's, if I could, just the third part. Here's why I'm concerned. Yeah. in an opposite world of the Cover Oregon, I actually am concerned about what happens if it comes out and it's very similar to the old Homeland Security coloring, where it made sense, but the pieces were so complex that it scared people in ways that they never anticipated when they put the data together. So I ask you to be very clear about what types of things people are going to take out of context and be prepared for that. And the third question, and this is more of something that we can't know, but I am very concerned about it, given the very recent change in, shall we say, national direction, there's going to be certain types of data that some people might be concerned in terms of, oh, I don't know, demographic information that could be theoretically now a website away from certain federal agencies that might be looking for certain types of folks. And I want to make sure we are crystal clear about what things will and will not be used for. Thank you.
Representative McLean.
Thank you. I think all my privacy questions have been answered, and I think, you know, there's a lot to think about there. But I want to go on to another one. My question originally was going to be, is this pure data? And the answer that you just gave to Representative Evans was it's fairly neutral data. And so, to me, those don't equal one another. And the reason I asked that was because of one of the comments that the first presenter made, and that was that this would offer researchers and teachers and administrators and a lot of other folks to make decisions on if they think that IB, AP, or dual credit was actually helping a student more than another. Well, to be able to do that, you've got to assume that every AP, every IB, and every dual credit, you know, expression are exactly the same. And I know that IB has a very international experience, right? And that those things happen in different ways around the world. And so even an IB type of curriculum is not just exactly the same. The test may be the same, or the instruction or the units may be the same, but there are some people who might stress one part of the curriculum more than another because of where they live or, you know, where they're located or geography or history or what's going on in current events. And so my long-winded editorial type question is, you know, where are we on what you're calling putting parameters around what they've got in this fairly neutral and what I would hope to be would be pure data with some kind of sideboards?
Yeah. Chair Doherty, Representative McLean, I appreciate your comment, and I didn't mean to say that the outcome of the data is neutral, but the data itself is presented in a neutral way. We aren't linking this necessarily to accountability measures. It's information that we are collecting for multiple uses. And I think with any effort in which we use data that's available to us, context matters. And in a given area of policy or practice, conditions matter. And I think those have to be taken into account when we transition that data into research and findings. And so I don't think ever look at this data as saying this is the end all of our conversation. It's how might we use this new functionality in ways that I think can help empower effective practice that supports student learning, or broader questions around how we allocate scarce resources. And all of the within that spectrum, there's a number of different ways in which we can use it. But I certainly would not want to say that we should look at the data alone.
Okay, thank you. Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Another follow-up question to actually kind of piggyback a little of what Representative Evans said, and I'm sorry if I missed it at the beginning of a hearing right in another committee right walking through the door, but have you publicized what the data sets are that you are going to put into the system? Did I miss that early in the presentation so that maybe we have a chance to have some back to you? Because I know since I've been here, we've said that we're going to collect information on kids about mental health. We're going to, you know, do a bunch of healthcare pieces. We collect data on free and reduced lunch. I'd be curious what actually are the data inputs that you are intending to put into this system.
Yeah. Chair Doherty, Representative Parrish, appreciate the question. I'll answer the first part, which is we are not at that stage of publicizing this. And I think it's a important statement that I've heard today in terms of how we, once the system is operational, how we help to build awareness around it, what its purpose is, what its uses can be, and certainly provide some support in that regard. Relative to the data sets, I'll look to either Peter or John here to answer specifically on that.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, Representative Parrish. And this might be a good opportunity for us to do a follow-up. There are so many data sets at the Oregon Department of Education. There's, 40 or 50 tables or something like that of data. And it's sort of how it came to be in Oregon that we collect data from school districts. There's a lot of different collections. There aren't quite as many from the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission, but there's quite a few data sets, none of which include anything having to do with behavioral health. I think there was another one, or healthcare records. And there is discussion in states, not only Oregon, about that students are not just in education, they're also often receiving Department of Human Services or healthcare services, and that might provide efficiencies to the state to have things like that in a data system. None of that is currently in this system. It's not at the Oregon Department. It's not the Oregon Department of Ed, and it won't be in ours. But if you really wanted an accounting at the more granular level, we could provide that.
I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I doubt you can answer this question today, but I'd like the answer very soon. I realize there's a lot of staff hours that we can't account for. What's the cost of the system thus far, and what will the cost be to maintain this system?
Chairman Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Starr. I'm the project director for the statewide longitudinal data system. Under 2016 short session, the project was approved for a little over $5 million. For the upcoming 17-19 period, it's roughly $3.78 million that we're requesting. Of that 3.87, approximately a million of that is to finish the project, and the remainder is operations and maintenance of the system. So all in, we're a little over $8 million, including the O&M. Project cost is about six.
Brief follow-up. Phenomenal answer. Wow, I'm impressed that you had that so handy. So there, until the 16 session, there was no money allocated for this the first 5 years?
That is a correct statement. There was some bridge funding and some early planning funding that was in place before my time, with the exception of the bridge funding, which actually brought me into the mix of things. Prior to that, it was more initiation and planning. That round numbers is about $700K. Bridge funding got us from that period, which was $550,000, to presenting to the 16 session and getting approval for the execution piece. And that got us through the stage gate process that state CIO requires.
Thank you.
So, yeah, all in, we're, I want to say, total project cost, about 7.2.
Right, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. It's interesting information, and I like the idea that, you know, we find out, we look at second graders and where they're going to be in 10, 12, 14 years, and look at that kind of data to see where we can improve, what we did well, and so on. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, with that, I close the informational hearing on state longitudinal data systems. And I'm going to turn over the gavel to Representative Wilson for a public hearing on this. You want to say something?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Wilson.
Okay, now I have to wake up. 4657.
Yes.
Okay. Do better than that, Wilson.
Nobody give you lessons here.
Well, no, that's okay.
We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2657. And Alethea, if you would describe that bill for us, please.
Yes, Vice Chair Wilson, members of the committee, House Bill 2657 establishes an out-of-school youth task force. It charges the task force with evaluating state policies and procedures that have unintended consequences of providing disincentives for school districts participating in the re-engagement efforts for out-of-school youth. This bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. There's no fiscal or revenue statement that has been issued. There is a dash three amendment that's available on OLIS. The dash three amendment removes the out-of-school youth task force and replaces this with the taking the Youth Development Council to develop a statewide plan to provide the out-of-school youth with opportunities to become re-engaged, and it requires the plan to provide out-of-school youth with opportunities to become re-engaged and succeed in education.
All right, thank you. Testifying today, Representative Doherty, take it away.
Thank you. Representative Will, Vice Chair Wilson, Vice Chair Hernandez, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Margaret Doherty. I'm the state rep for Tigard in Southwest Portland. And here speaking in support of House Bill 2657. You know, dropping out of school is not the result of just one event. It's often a process and a series of events that occur as a result of the students leaving or disengaging in school. And as a former high school teacher in an area that was sometimes economically distressed and had family problems and so on, I heard probably of the students that left the high school 40 different reasons for it. Luckily, a lot of them came back, but that's what we're just trying to work on. But House Bill 2657 is a great tool in helping Oregon develop a plan that addresses the variety of reasons that youth leave or disengage in schools. This bill charges the Youth Development Council with convening stakeholders to develop a plan to serve vulnerable youth who leave school and to ensure that they have pathways for youth to reengage in school and in the workforce. And the thing that's really exciting about this is it's not only working with educators and so on, but sometimes with community colleges, with unions, outside groups that work with disengaged youth. And so it's a great opportunity to get a lot of people together to come up with solutions to this issue. As an educator, I know how important it is that we have systems in place that can help engage youth who may be on the cusp of leaving school, and this bill will help us better understand how community stakeholders, state agencies, workforce, and other applicable stakeholders can best serve our youth early and also on the back end of youth who leave school. If you have 10 students who leave or disengage from school, it's likely you have 10 very different reasons. And what we want to do is that with the task force is to have a plan that will help better understand these varied reasons and develop a plan that helps bring the students back. In a time when we're focusing heavily on graduation rates, I believe the task force created, or in this case, giving the opportunity over to the Youth Development Council, will be a great vital step in truly serving the vulnerable students all across the state of Oregon, and especially when I emphasize all across the state of Oregon because we really want to look at this from a regional basis also. And so anyway, we want to make sure that we have systems in place that work and that achieve the educational and workforce goals. So thank you very much, and I'm very happy to answer questions before we turn it over to the experts.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Doherty. Representative Springer.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, just more technical. So really what we're looking at is the dash three.
Yes.
At this point, which is basically replacing the bill. And the dash three is still to only establish the task force, correct, as I'm going through this?
Yes. If you guys want to answer
why don't
the
I just leave that question there, and I bet you hit some of it.
They're
in
going to go
testimony.
In more into detail on this because we've been working closely for a couple of months on this. So
thank you. Any other questions?
I don't see a number mentioned here as far as it relates to the number of people who will be on the task force. And I think usually I do on task force bills.
Well, this is something, in fact, are you guys going to be going over that? Because in the body of the original bill, it goes through and says it will be a person from this agency, from this school, from this educational. And so I'm sure that Mr. Hansel will go over what that is, unless you want the answer right now.
That's okay. I'll be happy to wait for it. But I don't notice it in the base bill either. So.
Okay.
Okay. Any further questions for Representative Doherty? Okay, seeing none. Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
Mr. Hansel, please, or Ms. Bell.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Bill T. Hansel, representing the Oregon Youth Development Council. Chair Doherty and Representative, or Vice Chair Wilson, and members of the committee. We're very excited about the amended bill, dash 3, as it stands. It does two things. One is that it establishes guidelines for a plan, or asks for a plan, and then two, the establishes a task force to make the recommendations to basically flesh out the plan. So there, it's kind of a two-part thing. You'll see section one and then section two. Then, as Vice Chair Wilson identified, there is not a cap on it, or the actual numbers. The membership is specified in terms of who needs to be on it, but there is not a cap. And it's not one of those, you know, it's, we want to have a nimble committee, so it's not something we'd, you know, we want to be able to address, but we're happy, you know, it's not, so, you know, we'd be happy with a max if that, or a membership, you know, it's not intentional that there wasn't one. So so those are the two questions. Just are there any others?
If you want to go in a little more depth into what the program is that we've talked about.
You bet. In summary, the bill seeks to solve the problem of not having any unified or coordinated effort to address the needs of out-of-school youth in terms of a re-engagement model. This bill does two things. One is it looks at re-engagement into education and re-engagement as a continuum of the workforce. Our age group, one of 16 to 24, some of the youth will have aged out of school at that point. Junior college, community colleges, higher education, and workforce are our primary options there. So it's really an inclusive approach when you throw in a workforce. Ultimately, what it allows is the question to be asked is what is best for this individual youth? And in order to answer that, it's kind of a silly question if there's only and always one possible answer. And so creating multiple pathways, multiple options, kind of gives teeth to that question of what's best for this youth. We hope in the plan to engage regional areas to identify what the strengths are, existing strengths of that region are in terms of programs that may already exist or strengths that they have that can be leveraged to build out a re-engagement model. And then there is ongoing work around the nation. The task force is tasked with looking at those, identifying what might be a good fit for Oregon, and then presenting those findings back to you in terms of recommendations for legislation that may create unintended consequences to those re-engagement, and then the variety of different plans. As you might have heard folks testify on the re-engagement piece on Monday, there are numerous different options, but a breakdown of the three primary ones are re-engagement back to the high school. This typically happens with a youth that may have had life events, instability, a traumatic event that happened in the household or to them, and it leaves them out of school for a while. They want to go back. They were happy with their school. That's one option. The other one is if the high school wasn't a good fit for them, and for whatever reason they may have been pushed out, felt unsafe, made some poor choices, and now they want to seek other opportunities to finish. Typically, that then looks like an alternative school. Could be a GED plus type model program where it's a GED and then on to community colleges. The other one is using community colleges as the high school, so allowing them to take the credits they need at maybe at alternate times in a traditional high school allows, so they can work during the day or evening and then earn a high school diploma and have a lot of their credits ready for for the associate's degree to continue on. And then finally, the last piece is more of the workforce orientation of in terms of, okay, perhaps your need is exorbitant at this point or dramatic, and you may need to earn money to the best of your ability at this time, and we want to create or see that those needs are addressed in terms of a living wage career orientation that allows them to gain the experience. And that's where the unions come in, who are actually looking for youth to apprentice with them. There's a whole variety of apprenticeship models, mentoring models that can be used that allow the youth to gain skills that put them on a higher income earning trajectory than, say, just picking up a job at a fast food restaurant or something that's not really a career-oriented model. So that, in a nutshell, is what it attempts to do. One of the things we have keen insight into is that the dropout rates among Native American youth are way off the charts compared to others. We are actively proposed to engage the 9 federally recognized tribes to look at links and inherent strengths that are going on both within their communities and then with the schools and workforce systems that serve their the tribes.
Thank you. Okay, are there any are you here to support in expertise, Ms. Bell?
Representative Doherty, Vice Chair Wilson, Vice Chair Hernandez, my name is Iris Bell, and I'm the Director of the Youth Development Council. And yes, I'm here in support of this bill. I think it's very, very important. Many of you know how passionate I am about looking at those young people who are not in school and not working, and how we have a responsibility to support them and to get them back on track, because they definitely have a role to play in our state, in our state's economy. And I think that we just simply cannot ignore the fact that we have a responsibility to help support them.
Okay. Any questions, the panel? Representative Vile.
Chair Doherty, just two questions. Cost, what's our estimate of what we're going to need to staff this up and run this thing?
If I may, thank you, Chair Doherty, Representative Vile. If the question is for a re-engagement system, type of fully functioning re-engagement system that...
Just asking the task force.
For the task force. Thank you. What we're asking for or estimate is around $46,500 to engage the regions, to consult with experts, and to fully inform the plan, and that's... that is what we have estimated over the course of the little over a year or so, and right about a year if that 91-day time frame.
Follow-up, Madam Chair? Mm-hmm. And do you have a list already of the public and private organizations that you're going to be overlapping with, whether it's the unions or other agencies, folks that are already engaged in one way or another with the types of programs you're looking at?
Thank you, Representative Doherty and Representative Vile. We have a good idea, but again, part of the So if it's task force membership, there it's detailed there with the addition of being able to add other experts. But we anticipate that those will vary by regions depending on the type of existing strengths. But a general idea is a higher education, Oregon Department of Education, the workforce systems, local unions, local stakeholders, and very importantly, local community-based organizations. We would point out that youth are not raised in schools or programs. They're raised in families which reside in communities. So when they leave those other systems, they go back to their families, they go back to those communities, and a large part of the work that we do is engaging those community-based organizations, community providers who have a really strong idea of what the local context is. And so we want to bring them on board, but they, again, differ from community to community across the state. But those are the type of the input that we're seeking to really allow for a unified system. Portland's going to look a lot different than Southern Oregon, Southeastern Oregon, but they can both be equally effective because they're based on the strengths that are available in that region.
Representative Solomon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the comments that Representative Vile was bringing up, too, and making sure that as we're looking at these, I think basically is fabulous work. I think it's great focus to be looking at. As I mentioned before, there's been states that have, and even in your findings, that are doing some of this work. Making sure that we're not reinventing the wheel all the way across. Mm-hmm. So what is working? And I get the representation, but how are we finding out what's working in a certain district? You know, so how is you know, Hillsborough addressing this issue? How is Portland Public Schools, and what kind of results and things are they looking at? Rather than just looking at those regional people who are invited to the task force, that may not have systems in place. Mm-hmm. So how are we bringing in that data from the districts that are seeing some success in this matter? And then you had mentioned about Native American. So how do we look at how you had mentioned the tribe incorporating the tribes that involved in part of the solution? So how are we also looking at how other potential states are making a part of the
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, Representative Solomon, thank you for your question. And I believe that it's really about the approach that the task force will take. We know that partnerships are absolutely essential to this endeavor. For one thing, if we don't have partners that are on the other side of reengagement, our schools, our workforce, community colleges, whoever it may be, there's nothing to re-engage a youth to. Mm-hmm. And if we're unable to track them and in terms of collect data on effectiveness, then it's really a re-enrollment system, which also would rather, you know, it's re-engagement, which means long-term continued success. What we envision, and again, this would be part of the ultimately the task force decision, but part of the money is attached to engaging essentially local communities. We say region, but it will be so that we can identify and have the stakeholders at the table. Unbeknownst to us, there may be a community college that's doing great work. That's part of the task force, is to find out, hey, this is a grassroots thing, completely local. It sprung up here, but we want to learn about it because it may have application to another similar community. Mm-hmm. Or likewise, Medford High School or Medford School District might be doing something great that isn't, on a national radar or really hasn't been investigated. It's known in the local area. So this is part of what we really do want, and this is why one of the things that came forward is that it is complex. There are ripples that, you know, you change one thing and there's ripples throughout the system. And so to really give it the attention that it needs to build out both the strengths and then identify repercussions of what it is that's being asked or designing a system that is truly unified, it requires multiple stakeholder input and that voices be heard and we consider everything to the extent that we're able.
And sometimes it's as simple as I had one instance that this young student was going to drop out. And basically, it was over clean clothes. Mm-hmm. This child, young man, was very embarrassed to come to school every day. And so we went through and worked, and this was dozens of years ago. And so we went through and looked at that, and I know that even something as simple as putting a washer and dryer into a school is something that has kept kids in. And so, you know, we're talking from the spectrum from everything like this. Mm-hmm. But this is what the task force will look at.
Chair Doherty,
and what the local needs.
Yeah. So Chair Doherty, Representative Salzman. That is the case. We're gonna look at local best practices. So we will be looking in communities and in schools to say what is happening locally. What are the best practices that communities are utilizing to keep their young people engaged, to bring them back, to re-engage them? And then we're also going to look at those national best practices to say, where can we draw from without reinventing the wheel to ensure that we are pulling in some of the best information, the best evidence with respect to what works in a community or what works for a state. And that's why, to some degree, we've looked up at the state of Washington. We've already kind of gone through all their legislation and pulled out some of the things that they have done that has made their model quite successful. But again, this task force will be turning that kind of information, that best practice and literature, the research, over to them. And this is the group that for the next year or so will be taking a look at what's happening, perhaps visiting some of these sites, going out and asking the questions about really what works in community. And at the end of that year, we will be bringing back a full report to you and making some recommendations at that point.
Okay. Representative Wilson.
Thank you. That may have partially answered my question, but let me ask it again, and that is that, say, for instance, this task force is formed and does what it is supposed to do, brings back information. It will be shared, I understand, with the legislature. Will it also be shared with the education hierarchy here in the state? And I guess I would ask you, as members of the Youth Development Council, will you follow this up to make sure that it doesn't just disappear into a black hole?
Chair Doherty, Vice Chair Wilson, members of the committee, absolutely. That is our charge. Part of our mandate is to take a look at statewide systems and to report back and to help align those systems across state agencies. And so where we see the need, we will be making recommendations to you and, of course, seeking out those particular partners and agencies to say, here is what we find, here is what the task force has recommended, and following up with you and with them to ensure that piece of that recommendation that has an impact on that particular agency is addressed, because that's what's going to make this work, that folks actually, when we take a look at those recommendations, they actually act on them, and we see the progress as we move forward. And at all points in this, making sure that we report back to you on that progress, or where we hit a wall, or where we don't get the cooperation that we need. I mean, that would be something that we would have to say, you know, we've worked on this, we've made these recommendations, we've shown you these recommendations, but we need this particular component or piece to be delivered, and we need some support and being able to get that to happen.
Thank you. Follow up?
Follow up.
Not a follow up question, but I know this is probably like asking how much does a car cost, but I want to ask a couple of our members of our committee who have been around for a while. Any word on how much a task force actually costs to staff? I think it's a great idea that they're bringing forward, but I'm just wondering how much. How much a task force costs?
Well, sometimes...
Can I look at you, Representative Parrish?
Well, I was going to say, sometimes the agency itself absorbs it under their own budget. And so it's the idea of we will not pay for a staff person to do X, Y, Z because we're going to just use the staff person under our current budget and that kind of thing. So I know that LFO went through and did not have it as a huge thing. But my experience is it all depends. I've had task forces that have cost literally nothing and brought it out. And then there's others that, you know, and some of these people that, you know, I've been on task force and they give me a little thing to fill out for per diem and I just throw it away. Hmm. So it's that kind of thing.
Thank you. I've asked for a task force too and I'm hoping it'll cost nothing.
Yeah. Did you have an answer from Mr. Wilson here?
Not really. I have a question.
Well, there's somebody ahead of you, and then you will do it.
Don't have a good thought-out question. I have an opinion, and I don't think we need that. Somebody's ahead of me.
Yes.
Chair Doherty, Representative Wilson, might I give you a little bit more context? You know, we are going to utilize our existing staff, and we've already identified how that's going to work, so there won't be, like, FTE assigned or anything like that that's necessary outside of what we already have on staff to do the work and to actually do the staffing of the task force itself. And so those particular pieces will be taken care of by the division in the department.
Okay. Representative Hernandez, then Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just to touch base or keep it into similar to what folks were already asking, there's a lot of overlap in some of the requests that are being made in terms of looking for best practice for parent engagement. I think we're going to see a bill come up with that, a task force around parent engagement, or even the barriers that exist institutionally within the current education system in mm-hmm. school districts of what's preventing folks from coming back after they've dropped out or stopped engaging. And will this task force also look for what kind of information other agencies are looking for as well, so that we know that, or you all know that to pay particular attention to whether it's if you find information around parent engagement that was informative, so that you can help inform other projects or systemic barriers that prevent folks from coming back into the school system.
Right. So, Chair Doherty, Vice Chair Hernandez, members of the committee. That is some of the work that we initially even did with respect to forming this particular work around re-engagement. We sought out the agencies and we sought out the individuals in state government who were working on this issue from various angles, and we brought them to the table to help inform the work that we were about to do, and we will continue to keep those people engaged and the components of work that they're working on, because you're right, we need to bring that together to be able to take a look at this the entirety of the re-engagement process. And that re-engagement process does indeed have various aspects to it that could have you looking at things like a homeless youth or looking at someone who needs extra credits or to actually reclaim credits. There are various individuals and agencies in state government that actually do some of that work. So we would definitely look to have them at the table and have their expertise. And some of those are called out in the bill itself. So we'll definitely be following up on that.
Representative Springer.
I was going.
I'm sorry.
I might, to Chair Doherty and members of the committee, Representative Hernandez. One of the things, as Director Bell has pointed out, is the perspective from the Youth Development Council is also on youth, and so the distinction there, and I say this as a mantra almost, but. A system that serves all youth will necessarily serve all students, but a system that serves all students doesn't necessarily serve all youth, and so that's the piece that we look to support in this, is that dropout prevention efforts, students, graduation improvement, students, and we want to align and support that For sure, absolutely. And so information that they, that those ongoing efforts inform our practices mm-hmm. and likewise what we find out from there to support those practices, it's really a yes and. So yes, this and that. So prevent and treat. And that's really the, we're not willing to give up on the generation or the youth that, that are currently out there. And many of them, you know, may, you know, the, there's an advocacy piece here, and that's where we look to how to engage those parents as well, the agencies that serve those youth already in their communities that may be the advocates for these populations. And ultimately, that's another thing that we see is that without question, the data bears out that the youth that are disengaged are overrepresented in underserved populations. Also, the LGBT community youth, foster care youth, mm-hmm. homeless youth, virtually every youth that represents or that we see in what's called an achievement gap or opportunity gap is represented here. So by virtue of strengthening re-engagement efforts, we quite equitably will cover and re-engage these specific populations of youth.
Yeah, just you. A quick follow-up.
Very quick follow-up, because we've got quite a bit to do yet.
Somebody who ran a nonprofit for the last 5 years that engages the youth that have dropped out and have fallen through the gaps, and particularly focusing on youth of color and youth with disabilities and youth who have experienced homelessness. There are community-based organizations like the one I started that have a gem amount of information and best practices mm-hmm. that nobody knows about. Mm-hmm. And we're pretty effective when it comes to re-engaging young people of color into jobs. And I hope that you keep in touch to the base of the communities so you can find these gems and really present to us a way that we can invest in practices that are already working.
Thank you, Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So very briefly, as I read the bill, the amendment now, it doesn't look like there's any asks of school districts, and the date of this is, what, September 15, 18, so you're more than a year out. But what I've heard in a few of the comments is what you're going to be doing in schools. I'm concerned that there's going to be an ask of schools while you're doing the task force, whether that be data or whatever, because I just think we need to leave schools alone for a little bit.
Mm-hmm. So, Chair Doherty, Representative Springer, I'm sorry, could you express that concern?
Clear. When I read the bill, I don't see you're asking anything of schools.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. When I hear you speak, sometimes I hear you're going to be in the school doing this or doing that, and I want to know that the schools are not going to be required to be doing anything.
Right. Chair Doherty, Representative Springer, this is why we're looking at our partners at the community-based organization level. Okay. Many of them already have the relationships with their schools, and so we wouldn't necessarily need to go directly to the school. As Representative Hernandez is saying, there are community-based organizations, many of them in, across the state, even Boys and Girls Clubs, have those relationships already in place. And so what we're seeking to do is to go to that community-based organization and say, how is it you're helping, or what part are you role are you playing in re-engaging young people? They then have plans and programs in place that we can speak to. They also have data. That's another thing that a lot of folks don't understand about what's happening now with the sophistication of community-based organizations. They have the data, they understand the student populations, and they know what's happening, and they have the relationships with the schools, which makes it a piece where that we don't have to necessarily go that route.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, any other questions? We are actually going to temporarily close this hearing, go to Representative Wisnett, and then reopen the hearing because we have about three other people signed up to testify. Is that correct? Or do we have anyone else signed up that wants to testify on this bill before we? Nobody? then I guess we don't have to close it and then reopen it.
Okay.
If not.
Okay,
then what we're going to do is close the hearing, and then we're going to reopen it, okay? So we're temporarily close down the public hearing on House Bill 2657, and we are going to open up a work session on House Bill 2219.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, House Bill 2219 requires school districts and public charter schools to offer students sufficient courses in civics. This bill takes effect on July 1st, 2018 for the 2018-2019 academic year. It was previously heard on February 20th, 2017. Currently at this time, there's no fiscal and revenue for that version of the bill. There is a Dash 1 amendment which changes the requirement that school districts and public charter schools offer the courses in civics to now they encourage districts and charter schools offer this course. There is a revenue and fiscal on this. There's no impact on either.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Doherty, I move to adopt the
Dash one
amendment dated February 17, 2017.
Okay, Representative Hernandez moves to adopt the Dash one amendment dated February 17, 2017. Is there any discussion? Okay, so it's now encouraging, not requiring. Okay, so if not, there's no further discussion, then the Dash 1 amendments are adopted.
Chair Doherty, I move HB 2219 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hernandez moves House Bill 2219 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am very happy about the amendment that urges and takes away the requirement, because if it had been a requirement, I'd have to vote no. And so I'm glad that we can support this. School districts obviously have the option whether or not they do this, and this is something of value that brings it to their attention.
Okay, thank you. Any other further discussion? Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate the fact that it is urge, encourage, support, but I hope that school districts across the state are listening, that this is a plea for recognizing the critical nature of civics and making sure that the connectives between a public that does not understand how government works and the unanticipated and anticipated consequences that we find ourselves in having to do with structure, systems, and fundings are related. So hopefully the message will be heard loud and clear, and hopefully more people than not will see that it is strongly encouraged to implement this.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments? Representative Solomon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would also like to echo what Representative Evans said, and also if there was some way that as we're looking at these opportunities, if there was some way that we could, you know, when we were talking about financial literacy earlier, at an earlier date, they were talking about all the organizations that really work with these in the community. If there was some way that we could share with our districts of these of these organizations that are doing these programs to encourage them and say, here are your
And actually with civics we do that.
Uh-huh.
So
you list
so through the Classroom Law Project, absolutely.
Okay.
So any other questions, comments?
My comment is to support what's been said, in the sense that when you mandate things without pay or without any kind of funding, you know that they're going to have to do something at home to figure out how to accomplish it.
Yep.
I'm horrified at the fact that there are social studies classes not being taught in the middle school, that there are some social study events that are being put into language arts classes, which is fine, but it's not what the kids need. They need a full social studies class. And I'm hoping that civics will be at least on the list of something to put in to the combined English class. But again, I think that what Representative Springer said today, and I know Representative Doherty has said the same thing, and that is that we have got to tell ourselves and the Department of Ed and everybody else, that this legislature, that if we want these things done, then we have to fund the education system so they can be done.
Mm-hmm.
And not just done, but done well.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's time for us to decide if we're here to give suggestions or if we're here to really support true education that is a combination of a wide variety of classes that offer a wide variety of students what they need to be successful in this world. And so I just needed a persuasive oratorical moment, but thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Any other discussion? Okay, seeing none, Matt, could you read the roll, please?
I would never use that phrase.
Yes.
But I like it.
Aye.
Representative Springer.
Aye. Sorry.
Representative Vile.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hernandez.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wilson.
Aye.
Chair Doherty.
Aye. Okay, with that, House Bill 2219 passes, and Representative Wisnett, would you like to carry that bill on the floor?
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay. Well. Okay.
Chair Doherty, I move to.
Okay, we close the hearing on that. Okay, so I close a work session on House Bill 2219 and open up a work session on House Bill 2229.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, House Bill 2229 modifies the Common Curriculum Goals, Performance Indicators, and Diploma Requirements set by the State Board of Education to now include financial literacy, requires school districts and public charter schools to include financial literacy instruction with current core subjects. This bill takes effect on July 1st, 2018 for the 2018-19 academic year. Previously heard on February 20th, 2017, no fiscal or revenue on that version of the bill. There is a dash two amendment that we're considering today. Dash two amendment changes the requirement that school districts and public charter schools offer courses in financial literacy to encouraging districts offer financial literacy courses. The amendment further clarifies the removal of the financial literacy course requirement, and it removes the requirement that the Common Curriculum Goals, Performance Indicators, and Diploma Requirements set by the State Board of Education now include financial literacy. There is a revenue and fiscal impact. Both have no impact, and there's no subsequent referrals.
Okay.
All right. Chair Doherty, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendment dated February 28, 2017.
Hey, Representative Hernandez moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendment dated February 28, 2017. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, I presume that the chief sponsor of the bill approves of the amendment.
Yes, they are his amendments. Okay, any other discussion? Okay, if not, the amendments are adopted.
Chair Doherty, I move HB 2229. I'll say that again. HB 2229 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Hernandez moves House Bill 2229 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none. Matt, could you read the roll, please?
Representative Evans.
Yes.
Representative McClain.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Solomon.
Aye.
Representative Springer.
Aye.
Representative Vile.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hernandez.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wilson.
Aye.
Chair Doherty.
Aye. Okay, with that, the motion passes. And again, we need a carrier on this. Representative Wisnett, would you like to carry this?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much. So with that, we close the work session on House Bill 2229 and reopen a public hearing on House Bill 2657. And we have signed up, and I'll just say whatever names we have. If you're here, come on up. Chris Vogel, Pam Blumenthal, and Peter Lavelle. Okay, thank you.
For the record, my name is Chris Vogel. I'm fellow education policy for the League of Women Voters from early learning K to 12 through higher ed, as well as the education budget. Chair Doherty, Vice Chair Hernandez, Vice Chair Wilson, and members of the committee. The League is here today to support the task force on out-of-school youth. We support policies and programs designed to increase job opportunities and provide opportunities and or incentives for basic or remedial education and job training. We know that students who disproportionately drop out are coming from groups with disabilities, students of color, students navigating poverty, and male students. We also know that many of these students have experienced adverse childhood experiences. They continue to struggle with both family conflict, and they also struggle with financial issues. And as we are working to increase our graduation rates, we've created some disincentives for the school districts to re-engage these youth. And I do believe that the Youth Development Council, with Mr. Hansel and Chair or Director Bell, have long-term experience in working with these groups and are well prepared, along with the Youth Development Council, to be able to take the support from this task force.
Okay, thank you very
happy
much.
To answer questions.
Any questions? Okay, thank you very much.
And thank you for what
and
you
then did. Also on OLIS, there is a letter of support from Jeff Parker, who is runs the Northwest Youth Corps. Mm-hmm. So that's also on OLIS. Okay, anyone else to testify on this bill? Okay, if not, we close the public hearing on House Bill 2657. And is there any other business before us? Okay, House Committee is adjourned.
Yeah, I hope you feel better.
House Committee is adjourned.